Hi, everybody. My name's Rita Q, recovered, not cured, compulsive eater and a leader for your meeting. I see I recognize some people there. It'd be great if somebody could co-host me just briefly as well, because I'd like to share something. But first, I really want to start with a prayer because I truly want to bring higher power in. So, Lord, take me where you want me to go. Let me meet who you want me to meet. Tell me who you want me to say. And please, please keep me out of your way. Keep me free of ego and self-importance. Always remain in your humble servant. I've got to do that because when I show up, it's all ego. And ego for me is edging God out. And I remember hearing once that ego has three things: make me right, make me different, and make me feel good right now, which is what, I wanted from the food as well. So I just want to start off. I'm a really big book girl. So apologies if I'm a bit of a big book thumper. I want to start off briefly about there is a paragraph in the big book that describes my disease down to a T. It's in the doctor's opinion. Page XXVIII, and it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So Rita Q ate her alcoholic foods because she loved the effect produced by them. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. I didn't think I ate that much. At 350 pounds, I thought it was an accident or something of equivalent. I thought, how did I get here? I used to tell people I didn't eat that much. I really did. And I remember one of my good friends is a doctor, and she was like, "How did you not know?" And I was like, "Because I couldn't differentiate the truth from the false. My compulsive overeating was all I knew. My weight went up as my age went up. I was very fit when I was younger, but when the fitness stopped, the weight just came on." And then it says, "To them, their alcoholic life, my compulsive overeating life, seemed the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented until, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, which you see others taking with impunity." So I basically that translates for me is I'm peed off, nobody's doing what I want. I'm the actor trying to run the show and everybody's running off stage and I'm stood there screaming at everybody until I can get a sense of ease and comfort. That is brief. You don't get the ease and comfort, you get the 8 second hit. And by the time but the when I was in the food, I was getting 3 seconds if I was lucky. Because I was shoveling it in so fast, I couldn't even taste it. I was just like a Hoover. And then it says, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over unless this person can experience an entire psychic change. And that is the problem with this disease for me. And the best way I can show for people who are listening to the recording, I'm showing a little diagram, and this is the disease. So here we are. I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. I'll send this out to anybody who wants, by the way. Then I start thinking about the food. Then I take the first bite. That's when the phenomenon of craving starts. Then the compulsion is fully locked in, and then I'm binging out of control, or just exercising out of control, or whatever I'm doing, and then I feel really bad. And then there we go. Set number seven, I'll never do it again. And if you had put me on a lie detector with the CIA at number seven, I'd have passed because I would have swore to you I'll never pick that food up again. But I was powerless over food and I didn't realize until I came into the rooms. So the thing is, our common problem for me anyway, I'm bodily different than my husband. He knows when to stop. He's like, "No, I'm full. I don't even have that in my vocabulary when I'm in the food." So that's the allergy. I've got the mental obsession. I'm mentally different than him. I think about food the way most people think about Brad Pitt or various other good-looking men or women in the world, I really do. And suffering from a spirituality, it's always I to the tune of me. I had a cosmic score chart, and if you did me wrong, oh my God, you made it onto that chart. If your present wasn't big enough for my birthday because it was at Christmas and you doubled up, I hated you for it. I didn't show it. I would have done anything for everybody, but God, did I keep a cosmic score chart? And I didn't even realize I was doing that. So the little resentments I pocketed, it tells us in the big book, resentment's the number one killer. My life, when you peeled it all away, was resentment, fear. And I'll give you a quick overview. I grew up in a war zone. I grew up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, the back end of the Troubles. And so the fear was built, locked in from an early age, but I didn't realize it because it was a normal life to us, the sirens and everything. And various other, the bombs going off, whatever, it was all seemed normal. But one thing I know is we were all quite big eaters in our family. I was never an alcoholic, by the way. I've never had a drink issue. I just don't drink. It's loaded in sugar and it was a gateway drug for me. I didn't discover drink till I came to England. I live in the UK now. I came to Manchester University, and when I started drinking, all bets were off because it just made me want food even more. And I came from this small little town. As I grew older, like I said, the disease is very progressive. You know, it's common, baffling, powerful. And as I grew older, the disease became stronger. As I put the exercise down, the weight piled on. Like I said, I got up to 350 pounds on my first go. 2002, I was diagnosed with a really rare autoimmune disease, very similar to lupus. They put me on a really high dose of steroids, where you can imagine as a compulsive overeater, all bets were off. I might as well have been drunk the whole time because I just could not get out of the food. And then in 2003, my sister-in-law, who is the most beautiful soul in the world, said to me, "Are you okay? You haven't stopped eating." And I thought, oh God, she's noticed. I was 25 stone for the Americans, was 350 pounds. How could she not have noticed? Like 155 kilos, of course. I could barely fit into seats. Nobody would want to sit beside me on the bus because I took up two seats. I used to bless myself getting on the plane that I could get the seatbelt on, or I used to have to put up and ask for the extender, and it was horrendous. And I remember like just hating myself. It was all self-esteem. I ate because I hated who I was, and then I hated myself for eating, and I just got locked into that cycle. And also the white noise. That white noise, I think anybody who's older who remembers the old transistor radios, especially if you move county to county, you'd be trying to tune them in, you'd hear, and you kind of get a sense of Madonna in the background playing Holiday or something. You're like, oh, I want to hear that song. That was what higher power was like, because when I'm in the food, my disease sounds like God, always. And 50% of my head will tell me lies, and the other 50% will believe it, you know? So I ate like Bill drank, and then I got into OA in 2003, I think, in the January. I had heard about it 2 years before when my brother tried to tell me, and I just took a real umbrage at that, as you can imagine, really injured. And then I came into OA, and I really thought I was going to be the biggest, smallest in the room. I got really excited, thinking, thank God, I'm not going to. And I walked in, and they were all slim, and I was like, hang on a second, what's going on here? And then, you know, I decided that I wouldn't eat. Sugar's a really big thing for me. So I decided I wouldn't have sugar unless I was going out to eat. And my husband said to me a couple of weeks into OA, he said, God, we're going out a lot to eat recently, more so than ever. He said, that's strange. And I went, are we? I haven't even noticed. You know, there's like, you didn't need to call Colombo on that one. I was completely manipulating the whole situation. So then I decided that had to go because I tried to hold on to it like a dying relative, I'm telling you now, and I couldn't. And then it was looking at that, and I worked the program really well, you know, got sponsored, got sponsees, attended face-to-face meetings, gave service where I could, didn't do anything at intergroup level, but stayed on my local level. And then a lurking notion talks about it in the page 33 of the big book, and I don't want to misquote it, but it says something along the lines of, you know, if we are to stop drinking forever, if we are to stop compulsively overeating, there must be no lurking notion. Oh yeah, 33. This contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remained sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. But here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. Just want to give you a heads up and a spoiler alert. You can't do it. I tried. Oh my God, did I try? I went out, I had a bite of something and the noise came again. That peace had gone, you know, that beautiful, you know, when you're sat in a spa and you can hear the ocean lapping and somebody's rubbing your feet and everything's wonderful. That's what recovery is for me. I was back on a dinghy in the middle of a storm, thrown up on the side of the blooming boat, you know, thinking this is hell on earth. And I was never bulimic, but you know, that awful, like, oh, just conjugate, it just brought up everything. So I started eating, the noise came back. And we had gone around the world for a honeymoon, and I first picked up on a flight to either Vegas or LA, I can't remember now. And then by the time I got round to Hong Kong, I was praying that they wouldn't leave binge stuff in the room. I mean praying. And that is batshit abstinence to me. That is like, don't let it be there, don't let it be there, don't let it be, or you know, it's emotional. My behaviors has come back as well. The emotional sobriety was kind of leaving. That boat had gone. And I was like, oh, so I was in and out of the food then for a long time. And I did get periods of absence, but I just see it as one big relapse. And I had lost something like 150 pounds, 140 pounds, put it all back on, even more. My dad dropped dead in the street, then my mom dropped dead, and then I got stage 4 cancer. This was all in the head of a couple of years with stage 4 blood cancer. And I had sepsis 9 times, and I thought, this is it now. And I just honestly must have physically tried to eat myself to death. And actually, I had a very massive spiritual awakening. For people who haven't heard this story, not everybody gets this.
Gentle reminder, 10 minutes.
Thanks, Rachel. I acknowledge. Not everybody gets the spiritual awakening, but I was so far gone. I was so far gone. God had to come in and slap me over the face. And I was in the bath. And for anybody who's been really big, letting the bath water out when you're in the bath as a big lady is not a good idea because there's no strength. And I had gone into the bath because the morphine wasn't working. I had really bad bone marrow pain. And I remember the nurse said, just have a, she said, does anything else work? And I said, really hot baths work. So I got in the bath and obviously I was a wee bit faint anyway. And the bath water had gone out. My nurse was tiny. She was about the size of Britney Spears. And I thought, she's never going to get me out of this tub. And I remember having a pull. And I just thought, I can't pull the cord to get her in to help me because I was completely immobile. And I wasn't stuck physically. I was stuck because I couldn't push myself up because I weighed so much. And I remember praying and I heard as clear as I'm speaking to you now, I heard you need to go back to Hawaii. And I was like, yeah, but you need to get me out of the blooming bath first. So I did. I had a wheelchair at the time, and a walker. So I was in a wheelchair for a while because I lost the power of my legs. I was able to get to the meeting and I've never looked back. It was over 5.5 years ago and I'm recovered now, thank God, by the grace of God, one day at a time. So what does that look like now and what's the difference? So I think the first few months I came back to Hawaii, I spent my whole time wishing for the abstinence I had the first time around. If that makes sense to anybody who's relapsed, I just wanted that back. And then I realized, you know what? If my disease is outside doing press-ups, my recovery has to be doing 3 times that. My recovery has to be qualifying for the Olympics. So I started to pray. And then, it tells us in the AA 12 and 12, nobody wants to admit complete defeat. But I had to, I got on my knees and I thought, step one, I am powerless over food. I proved it. So every day now, when I wake up, I say, God, my name's Rita Q. I'm powerless over food. Take me through the day and do not let me misbehave all day. And please, please tell me when I do. Because that's the thing now. I don't always know what God wants me to do, but I know what He doesn't want me to do. And I have 3 things now. Does it need to be said? Does it need to be said now? And does it need to be said by me? I have to remember that. Because the thing is, all goes well. It says in the big book, when we become disturbed, everything in my house is great until I open the front door or until somebody talks to me or the cat meows and then it all go and then I have to really pull in the tools of the program, So that's what I do in the morning. I really connect with God. I go swimming usually in the morning as well. So I find being in the water a really big thing. That's my real strong connection to God. I do have a cradle faith, but that's irrelevant. That was actually a barrier more than anything because I thought I've got this, I've got God, I've got God. I didn't use him, I had no relationship with him. I didn't believe he could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I just thought he was a nice ornament I could stick in the car or somewhere else, So that's what I do in the morning. And then I hand over my desk, make sure I connect with God. My 4 and 5 now. That's if I go deep with the 4 and 5, if there's a 10 that's sticking. There's always a 10 that sticks every couple of months. Something that I've done over and over. And I think I need to go a bit deeper in this. I need to really see my partner. So 6 and 7 character defects are now my step one. That's actually my new step one. The food doesn't talk to me anymore. I haven't got time for the food. It's emotional sobriety now. So step one, what are step 6 and 7? My character defects. What does it look like when I don't gossip? What does it look like when I don't shout, when I am patient? So it's about doing the exact opposite of my defect and recognizing when I do. 9 is about owning it. It's been a long time since I've had to do a real deep amends. Most of my amends now are living. But recently I was away for a month. I came in and my husband and I, it was just like coming. I had been away for a month and I just felt like the return to earth was really difficult. I don't know how astronauts do it. I was just thinking, woof, back in the house, and he was chatting away to me. He was so excited, and I was like, "I just need some space." But and I got a bit snarky, and I said to him, oh, "I'm really sorry. This isn't you. It's me. This is just me being tired and thinking this is acceptable behavior. It's not. I'm sorry." And he's like, "It's I mean, what it must have been like for him because he did not know what version of Rita he was getting when he came in when I came in the door. There was 100 versions of me, depending on where I was. So That's 6 and 7, 8 and 9 on a 10 now. 10, step 10. I can't ask what's the word? I cannot say how important step 10 is. for me, getting rid of my resentments and fear, it is taking out the trash, and I have to take out the trash every day. Otherwise, everything starts to stink, and I mean stink, and it sticks to me, and the smell sticks to me. And then I'm sticking it on you because the thing about a resentment is I'll resent you, and I'll resent you again. And by the end of it, I'll become the hero, and you'll become the devil. And that's no good for anybody. And that's what happens when I hold on to resentment. I change the story just ever so slightly to make it fit into my. To make me look good. That's what I used to do anyway before away. So when I do them straight away, I just see my part, you know. And I hear people say a lot, they will call me and say, oh, they made me. Nobody can make me do anything. I can choose, and that's the powerless versus helpless. I can choose not to call somebody if I pick up. I can choose not to do outreach calls. I can choose not to attend meetings. But the problem is, it's like a battery charger. I get 100% every day. I start off at 100% and that goes down. The minute I wake up, that starts going down. So, you know, 10 is where I empty my cup, and then sort of 11, I'm bringing the cup back to God, and I'm like, fill this up. Fill me up with, you know, the spiritual principle. This is spiritual awareness. So fill me up with that. Keep filling me up. And 12, then it's service. And 12 for me is one of the most important things, given service. It's the most, for me, it's the most beautiful thing. Coming here tonight, I go to bed an hour. I would have been in bed an hour ago, and I thought, just can't wait to be able to do this, because when I take God's hand, he can help me do anything. You know, it's not, life isn't about getting what I want anymore. It's about wanting what I have. And being in fit spiritual condition these days for me isn't about what I say. It's about my actions. You know, it's about my actions and what I do on a daily basis. So the easiest way to describe it for a newcomer is like a jack, you know, the jack in the box. They pop up. That's my disease. There it is. 6 a.m. when I get up, he's laughing at me, and I'm thinking, hang on a sec, you were down last night, but of course I've had 6 or 7, 8 hours untreated overnight. So I, you know, the whole day, I spend the whole day putting the jack back in the box, and there it is again every day. So, you know,
Gentle
there's a
reminder,
bit,
3 minutes.
thanks, Rachel, acknowledge. There's a Buddhist saying, and it says, you know, what do you do to get enlightenment? You chop wood and fetch water. But what do you do after? You know, the guy says, Master, what do you do after you get enlightenment? And he says, you chop wood and fetch water. Consistency for me is the only form that I have in my recovery. And there is days I come to this, and it couldn't be more beautiful. The sunrise is beautiful. The sunset's beautiful. The cat meowing, waking me up at 3 a.m. Isn't he cute? There's other days I want to fling the cat out the window, you know, and that's what step downs are for. I'm not perfect, and I try my best. You know, I really do. I see step 1 to 3 is just giving up. I see 4 to 6 is cleaning up. 7 to 9 is making up, and 10 to 12 is basically growing up. You know, I came into this program like a child almost, you know, in the way that I behaved emotionally. And that's what it's about for me now, emotional sobriety. And I'll just share these, some of these are quite old, but I just wanted to share, if I'm okay, I just wanted to sort of show my journey in a way, because I thought it might help you understand the differences. And it's not about the weight for me, but it is when I'm wearing the disease. Oh, I can't share, it's no problem. When I'm wearing the disease, you know, that's how it manifests in me. So I just have to keep looking. And you know, for anybody who's really, really struggling with the food, I was there, and I remember praying not to eat. The thing is, it's getting on my knees and saying to God, I can't do this anymore. You have to take this away from me, because my life now has changed so much. You know, it's like, it's about saying please in the morning and thank you at night, and in between, helping my fellow sufferers, suffering compulsive overeaters. And you know, you have to kind of lose hope to become, you know, you have to be hopeless to find hope again. And that's what I found with my relapse. I had to become hopeless, because you know, the definition of a bottom is different for
Gentle
everybody. You can
reminder,
define
1 minute.
that. Thank you, Rachel. Perfect. So, you know, when the human emotion knocks, my intelligence, when it goes up against the human emotion will always win. So I have to rely on God to keep me straight. So for anybody, like I said, who's in the food, what I did at the beginning was I identified my alcoholic foods and the behaviors, because abstinence is not, it's not Sugars Anonymous. It's not Flour Anonymous. It's the action of refraining from. So now I respect my food. I don't eat standing up. I don't do anything quick. I sit and I hand it over to God and say, right, this meal's yours. And I eat my food. No distractions. And then, like I said, I look emotionally throughout the day because that's where it's going to get me. It's not going to get me now in the triggers. It's going to get me in my behavior. And that's the stuff that turns septic now. So I just want to say I'm really, really thankful for being a compulsive overeater, actually, because I wouldn't have had the opportunity to come today. And with that, I will pass. Thank you.